You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back with another virtual edition of the M Squared TechCast, or MI Tech TV, as we like to call it as well.
Yeah, we've got
a great show. We got a great show for you today. Lots of interesting guests. And Mike, why don't you introduce our first one that you folks can see right there?
Yes, calling in from London. We have a little international flavor today. We have a woman who's a publicist named Karen Black. And as a disclaimer, she's working with myself and my executive producer, Kate O'Hara, on some projects. But we were discussing, we were trying to come up with different formats because we've covered PPEs pretty hard and things like that. So we're trying to come up with more angles on how do you get through the pandemic when you're a business. And of course, later on, we'll do stuff about what happens after the pandemic, but none of us really know when that's going to be. So what Karen's going to talk a little bit about is keeping your brand top of mind during the pandemic, because if your business, if you stop advertising, you stop promoting your company, then what? You know, so take it away, Karen. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Matthew, for having me. For me, obviously, I'm a publicist and I brand build people through the media. And one of the biggest things or one of the biggest observations that I've picked up on is very often when there is a crisis or an economic meltdown, is obviously people stop spending. So my whole viewpoint on that is it's not necessarily about stop spending, but more about where are you going to put your dollar? And it's very important to consistently keep your brand and your name and face, in the forefront of people's minds. So if you just take Coca-Cola, for example, which is obviously a multi-million-dollar company, they don't have to advertise, but they still do. So, you know, I think that sometimes people panic and they fear, because this is what a lot of these kinds of things, whether it's an economic meltdown or the pandemic itself, is that, you know, it's really, I think, very, very important for people to be on top of mind. And that does mean publicizing and advertising your business.
Okay. So how do you cut through? How do you get through? I mean, there's only one story in the media right now. I know, myself as a PR guy, it's hard to get any attention for anything. So how do you get attention in an environment like this?
Well, I mean, I think the whole thing is that you really have to get to the story and the name and the face behind the brand, because as you know, if your product and your business speaks for itself, people really want to know the story. So if for example, you take, an Elon Musk or Sarah Blakely, a lot of what sold them and what's kept them at the forefront is their actual story and the name and the face behind the brand. So, it's about, taking those people, not only, sharing their entrepreneurial story, which a lot of people know, but also to talk about how they have had to adapt in the, in this environment and what they've had to do in order to keep their name and their brand in the forefront of what they're doing. So I think it's important, whether that's radio interviews, TV interviews, online editorial. And I think online editorial is obviously at this point more beneficial because people aren't going out and buying publications. Everybody's reading the information online. So I think the power of online editorial, you know, and whether it's, you know, Fox Business or CNBC or, you know, entrepreneurial programs or shows like yours, I think it's important for people to be on the forefront and be sharing how they've adapted and what they're doing.
So understanding the benefit of publicity is one of your notes here. Do you think people really understand that? I mean, it's because a lot of people that are still controlling the shots out there buying advertising or sponsorships are, say, Generation Xers or baby boomers. And so they had lived, they came out of a different world. Whereas as everything has moved to the internet, it's more social media, it's more storytelling. I mean, do they really understand that?
Well, I don't think many people, I mean, there are those that do because they would spend their dollar or they would spend that. But I think the majority of people really need to be educated on the benefit and why it's so important to do this. Because the other problem is that because the internet and social media is so oversaturated, I think what's happened is there's been a certain level of distrust that's been formed by the public or by, you know, entrepreneurs because there's just so much coming at you. So I think that still utilizing the traditional formats of media such as television, radio, I mean, obviously podcasts has become really huge now. But I do think it's important for people to understand the benefit because also that adds credibility to what you're already or what, you know, the company or individual is doing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Matt?
All right. So tell us a little bit about, I guess, the power of storytelling as part of marketing here. People, you know, think of marketing as sort of pound the brand, you know, pound the product, that kind of thing, but you really want to tell a story, right? So how do you go about doing that? What are some good creative ways to get that started?
Well, I think number one is obviously you have to have a marketable story. And as you've seen, you know, the likes of Elon, the likes of Sarah Blakely, the likes of Gary Vaynerchuk, you know, some of the bigger names. But part of what I've done in my own experience is I've taken people who have a really phenomenal story but aren't necessarily known out in the media or out in the public. And what I'm trying to do is raise the profile of the entrepreneur because many people, as you know, will look to billionaires and millionaires, but most people can't even put $1,000 in their pockets. So what I'm trying to do is show people, you know, that there are some amazing entrepreneurs, some amazing specialists in their field that haven't necessarily been seen in the public eye, but they're doing phenomenal things. And being able to find more relatable stories to show people, you know, that this is where someone was and this is where they are today. But you're not like trying to fill this massive gap between $1,000 and $1 billion, if that makes sense. So I think that it's important for people, you know, for those, the stories of those people to be told. Because so often everybody's looking to like big name celebrities and, you know, that's fine. And, you know, everybody's got a different aspiration, but that versus the reality of what's happening and how and what it took to get there. And I think that there are many people, as I've said, who are climbing and doing great things, but really need the platform and need to be able to share those stories. And that's where I've kind of filled the gap. And dealt with some phenomenal people, you know, like from one of the top female engineers at Tesla to, you know, different people in the automotive industry to entertainment industry, tech industry. So, you know, I think it's important for people and for those people stories to be told. And that's why I think the publicity is so good, but it's like Mike said, you know, it comes back down to educating people on the benefit of why it's so important. Because as I said before, if your product is good, it will speak for itself. But people really want to know the name and the face behind it. And that's what I do, you know, is basically help those people and facilitate interviews, whether it's radio, TV, magazine, or podcast.
So is it important to keep both your business branding and your personal branding very active right now at this time?
Absolutely, without a doubt, because, you know, I think what this pandemic has done, as awful as it is, I think what it is doing is it's also leveling the playing field, so to speak. And I think it's giving people an opportunity, because I think we have been going so fast and having so much coming at us. So I think in a way, this has slowed people down to a degree from the external distractions, and really kind of, you have to kind of recalibrate and, you know, come back. And I think it's vitally important now, because I think what it's also doing is it's eliminating the rubbish, so to speak. And I think that the people that come out of this are going to be, you know, the cream of the crop, so to speak. So I think that, in as awful as I said as it is, I think that it's vitally important that people, as far as their personal brand and their company brand, should be running both concurrently.
Matt?
Okay, talk to us a little bit about establishing credibility. I know, you know, we have people that, we think are experts in various topics, but how do you sort of establish that credibility as an authoritative voice?
Well, that's a, I think, very important question, and I think it's a very relevant question. I think the most important thing is that you have the credentials to back up what your mouth says, because if I go back to the point of having, you know, oversaturation on social media, what is important is, you know, a lot of people will say, and this is why, you know, like, I'll just take the coaching world, for example. Now, there's some coaches, obviously, that have done very well and been successful and run, you know, their own corporations or their own businesses. But for a lot of these people, you know, everybody was a coach. Everybody is an author. But then they're living in their grandmother's garage and they don't have two pennies to rub together. So I think that it's, you know, I mean, I'm just telling it like it is, because I think it's important, you know. And so it's, everything is about, you know, proof of work that you've done. You know, how could it, it's the same as me going to a financial advisor who's broke and asking him to give me financial advice. Like, why would I do that? So it's the same applies to publicity. The same applies to an entrepreneur running a business, is that at the end of the day, you have to have the credibility and the credentials and the proof to back up what your mouth says. And I think that that's really what has been missing for a lot of people, because I think you can, sort of do the whole smoke and mirrors thing and, you know, kind of do the whole fake it till you make it, which I really totally disagree with. But eventually people see through it. So the bottom line is you have to have the credentials to back up what your mouth says. And if you don't, then it's in some instances, go work for somebody, go get the experience, go and gain that experience and, you know, then apply it in your own business. But I don't believe that people should just be, you know, just should be smoke and mirrors or fake it till you make it. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, we've only got about a minute left. So at this point in the show, we let our guest provide some contact information about how folks can reach out to you if they want to work with you, get more information. How, what information do you want to provide?
So they could get me on Instagram, so which is Black Karen, and then they can also get me on Facebook, which is Karen Black, so it's K-E-R-R-I-N and then Black, or LinkedIn. They can find me on LinkedIn, or they can send me an email at so Karen at talentfinders.com.
Okay. Thanks very much, Karen.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
All right. Karen Black, thanks for joining us today. We'll be back in just a moment with another segment of the M-Squared TechCast. For right now, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're watching at podcastdetroit.com and mitechnews.tv.
What do you get at Lawrence Technological University? Everything. Great labs and studios, supportive professors, plus a full campus life, NAIA athletics, and all the software you need to succeed. Be smart. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Lawrence Technological University is all about opportunities. You learn beyond the campus, doing real-world research for top companies and honing your skills through co-ops and internships. Apply what you learn. Be challenged. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Lawrence Technological University graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU fifth among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
As a Lawrence Technological University graduate, you're not only marketable, you're worth more. Yes, more. According to payscale.com, when it comes to graduate salaries, LTU is in America's top 100. Be invaluable. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back with another segment of the M Squared TechCast from PodcastDetroit.com and MITechNews.tv.
Well, we've been waiting for one of our guests to call in from Oregon. Unfortunately, he has not done that yet. We'll keep our fingers crossed that he'll be able to join us. So in the interim, let's talk a little bit about what you guys are doing at Lawrence Tech. You've offered a new program that emphasizes not only technology, but humanities, which I think is an interesting twist. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, Matt?
Yeah. When I heard about this degree, I thought, gee, I wish they'd had this 40 years ago instead of a communications degree that I started out with and working for newspapers and now, of course, websites. But it's a Bachelor of Science in Technological Humanities is the name of the degree. And it's offered through our College of Arts and Sciences, the Department of Humanities, Social Sciences, and Communication. And it's a degree that combines high-tech skills with the humanities, things like writing and rhetoric and stuff like that. And we think it'll prepare people for the jobs of tomorrow that don't like directly involve technology like engineering. The curriculum starts with a freshman year that combines courses like mathematics, computer science, some of the natural sciences, chemistry and physics, that sort of stuff, with courses like literature and psychology and history. Sophomore year, the curriculum includes technical communication, more computer science and statistics, blended with courses in writing and rhetoric and economics. So they're really obviously trying to make it very well-rounded. Junior year, the students learn computer coding and they take other technical electives. And obviously at a school that, technology is its middle name, like Lawrence Tech, we've got a lot of technological electives, along with courses in history and ethics and literature. The senior year is dominated by a senior thesis elective. Internships are strongly encouraged during 4 years. This program already has its first student. It's a young woman from Port Huron, and she graduated from high school in 2018. She came to Lawrence Tech for architecture, and we have, one of the best architecture programs in the country. But her real passion was in writing, and she wanted to combine high tech and writing. She plans to concentrate in software engineering in the major. But she also hopes to write novels and write short stories. So she wants to become a writer with sort of tech on the side. Now, you might ask, what kind of job does this prepare you for? That would be one of them, this young woman that I just described. But we're thinking that these people will fill roles in companies that want to communicate their technologies to broader audiences, companies that have interpersonal skill needs in high-tech sectors. Basically, we're thinking what a liberal arts program in a future tech-heavy world would look like. So our students that want to delve into computer science, mathematics, or design, they can develop those skills while exploring sort of the social implications of artificial intelligence and big data and sustainable design. Similarly, students from the other side with an interest in communications or writing or cultural history can combine those interests with practical training in coding and website design and nanotechnology, as well as medical devices and others. We've got a big biomedical engineering program at Lawrence Tech that could become a part of this too. We think these people will be well poised for careers in science and technology journalism, public policy, sort of working with the government and elected officials on technology policy and economic development policy. And we also think they're going to be pretty interesting hires in website design and user experience. That they will have the background from people as well as the technological part of it. It's focused on what happens to you over an entire career and how to be a leader as much as anything.
Okay, so what prompted LTU to do this?
Well, it's basically, we wanted to sort of reinvent the humanities for a future in which everybody should basically know a little bit of computer coding and a little bit of high tech and a little bit of how websites work, combined with being able to evaluate content with a skeptical eye, which is what courses like philosophy and rhetoric and ethics and writing teach you. We've all heard a lot about, especially these days, about questionable content online. Tech savvy people who can talk knowledgeably about those things, I think, would be quite valuable to an employer.
All right. Well, we've got our guest calling in from Oregon. He's adjusting his camera here. That's Jeff Gross, who is a film writer. And actually, this might be a good segue, because what Matt, who works for a Lawrence Technological University, they just added a degree that includes humanities. Now, one of the things that, Jeff has written several screenplays, including a couple, I think, with Roman Polanski, right?
That's true. Yep.
Okay.
Bitter Romantic were the two we did together.
Okay, great. So what we were talking a little bit about was how things are changing. And I know that's one of your themes as well, in the sense of as we get through this pandemic, how you think filmmaking may change. And the other thing you wanted to talk about was Oriental medicine, because you have said that you thought that there were some folks that you had worked with that might have some ways of working on the COVID-19 situation.
Well, for starters, the film business right now is in uncharted territories. So, people are talking about maybe going to Sweden to shoot the films that have been delayed. People are talking about going to Georgia, the places that are opened up already. But there's not a whole lot of enthusiasm on the part of a lot of people to kind of jump into uncertain situations. So on a concrete level, the industry has been very hard hit and has had to shut down. Movie theaters obviously are shut down. They put 50 or so films on hold for distribution. So are you still there? I don't know if you're there.
No, I'm here. Yes.
Oh, yeah, we're here.
Okay, yeah, sorry. Everyone's kind of in limbo and waiting to see set temporary restart dates, but nothing is concrete whatsoever right now. So, they're talking about maybe doing more Zoom reality content, but yeah, everyone's pretty much on hold right now. And I'm personally not, when I saw the list of 50 films that were not going to be distributed, there was probably one I would want to go see, and the rest are all superheroes and that sort of bang bang stuff. And my question is anyone starting to think about other types of stories? Because that's, for me, that's been a dead end for a long time, those types of stories. maybe they attract the adolescents, but the rest of us don't listen to those things. I'm not seeing for the moment any real shift in consciousness about what sorts of films should be coming out, should be made, you know, even though a lot of people have been very strongly affected by this moment of reset, this moment where everything is stopped.
Let's talk a little bit about your Oriental medicine orientation. You were saying in some of the notes that I have here that you think you know some folks that might have possible, I wouldn't say solutions, but treatments perhaps.
Well, I've had Oriental medicine is sort of a hobby of mine. I've studied it extensively, and I had the enormous good fortune to find some people, an acupuncturist in Paris who was incredibly skilled. And to my mind, the things that I've witnessed her do to hundreds of people that I've sent her, it seems miraculous. There are operations which didn't need to happen. Once she treated people, there are cures for all sorts of disease which people said could not be treated. So I think she's way ahead of the curve. So she's had experience with a half dozen COVID patients, and given the variables of the mutations and what that particular strain might have been, she says that her experience is that the virus comes first into the large intestine and disrupts it, and then it incubates for 3 weeks before doing the mischief that we're reading about in the news, which is clotting up the lungs, sending blood clots all around. You know, instead of waiting for a vaccine, she's saying, well, what we need to do is pay incredible attention to our large intestines and do a 3-week cleanse, either through spirulina or through food grade bentonite clay, which is not the most pleasant thing to ingest, I can assure you of that. But the idea being to prevent the COVID from grabbing on the spikes, from grabbing onto the intestinal wall and then establishing a house, a nest. So for what it's worth, I find it personally very encouraging that we don't have to wait 5 years for a vaccine, that, you know, the cure is pretty much already there. It's just a matter of, taking care of the gut. But the interesting thing is that some researchers are beginning to go in that same direction. We had this conversation with my acupuncturist maybe 3 weeks ago. She's in Paris, where I lived for many years. It seems like researchers are maybe starting to catch up with that notion, but yeah.
Well, I know there is more, particularly in pediatric patients, attention being paid to the gastrointestinal manifestations of this virus. And also, it's just some of the symptoms are just bizarre. Everything from COVID toes to people who are apparently walking around and talking and acting completely normally, whose blood oxygen levels are so low that under any other circumstances you would consider them seriously ill. So, yeah. I mean, there's just so much about this that we don't know yet. And, you know, right. I think it's a sort of a global Apollo program that's needed to take a look at this to figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very much a fan of this. It's non-technological medicine, precisely because, you know, if you look at the horrible statistics about iatrogenic disease, which is the disease that is created when a doctor tries to heal you and you leave the hospital with a second disease or whatever, that's a huge problem. But yeah, she's just way ahead of the curve. And so I think, for my money, you could take it to the bank, even though there are no double blind studies and all the things that, which are meant to be, the gold standard in research. She's just way ahead of the curve. So, yeah.
All right. Well, at this point in the show, we let, Matt, you could talk about LTU because you started this segment real quick. And then, Jeff, if people want to reach out to you, we'll let you do that as well. Go ahead, Matt.
Okay. Well, if people want more information about this technological humanities degree, they can go to the website ltu.edu and click on the College of Arts and Sciences. and then the Department of Humanities, Social Studies, and Communications. That is where you'll find it. So once again, that's ltu.edu, Department of Humanities, Social Sciences, and Communications. And this degree is available immediately.
And Jeff, why don't you let folks know how they can reach out to you, get more information about you?
If you want, you can look at my website, which is mithsmith.com, which is mithsmith.com. And I have a few books on Amazon, one that I just republished, which is about living in Paris with all the starving artists I knew back in the 80s. And it's called Paris, the Last Golden Age. And then there's a second one called The Book of the Earth, which is all about my interest in Oriental medicine. And I think it's a very important book. So,
all right. Well, thanks very much, Matt and Jeff. And we're going to go to commercial break, and we'll be coming back with Drew Bennett, from the U of M. And he's going to be talking about a software program that they use to create 3D masks with a bunch of makers. But first, this is Mike Brennan.
And Matt Rausch.
And you've been watching MI Tech TV, and we'll be right back.
Lawrence Technological University graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU fifth among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
What do you get at Lawrence Technological University? Everything. Great labs and studios, supportive professors, plus a full campus life, NAIA athletics, and all the software you need to succeed. Be smart. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
And we'll see.
We'll see.
Okay, hey, it's Matt Rausch.
Right, Dave? Oh, okay. Here we go. Okay. Live TV, you just never know what's going to happen. So this is Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch.
And we're on our third segment. We have calling in all the way from Ann Arbor, where I am, is Drew Bennett, who's a software licensing director for the U of M, works in the engineering department. And one of the things that caught my eye a week or so ago, and we were going to try to get him on the show, was the U of M is working with some makers right now to develop 3D, it's face shields, right, Drew?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Why don't we talk a little bit about that?
So I think, as most people are aware, it's kind of been a difficulty through the entire pandemic and COVID-19 life cycle, if you will, that we've definitely had a difficulty getting a hold of personal protective equipment, and people in the health system generally are using a couple of things on a high need basis. And one of those is a face shield. So it's essentially a plexiglass screen, if you will, clear plexiglass screen. And then it's got a bit of I'll call it a halo or a headband on it. And they use this basically to try and deflect, droplets or anything that's liquid that might be coming towards the health practitioner. And then the other thing is obviously a traditional face mask. So a surgical mask, a lot of people have become familiar with language like the N95 mask type of thing. But the thing that we have been working with the local maker community with is printing the 3D halo aspect of it. So the part that really kind of goes around your head like a headband, and then snapping that together with a plexiglass shield. And producing those for not only U of M's health system, but the maker community in Ann Arbor's been doing that for all the other local health systems. So St. Joe, the VA, Michigan, obviously, and kind of got a lot of people rallied around a common approach and design over a period of weeks, and really produced a really, really significant amount of stuff. So for a lot of people who wanted to say, hey, how can I help? It's been a really interesting project to see come together.
Matt?
So what's happening with this? Are you like coordinating a small army of 3D printers operating to produce these things, or what's the U of M's role in this?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I would tell you that a lot of people, we won't claim credit for the idea at all. So a lot of people across the country really immediately, if Yankee ingenuity counts for anything anymore, people kind of said, we have this resource, what can we do? And a number of different designs were kind of established for this headband aspect of it. So there have been designs from any variety of different corners. We picked up a design that we had used successfully and made some modifications essentially to try and simplify it. And very early on, Michigan kind of established what we called a PPE donation center. So we were willing to accept donations from the community because people were asking us, I have a box of masks. I have, a bunch of Clorox wipes, that type of stuff. What can I do? And then we had the maker community come out and say, hey, we can make these for you. And what we've subsequently done is essentially over time in coordination with people like MakerWorks in Ann Arbor and a subsequent group of people called Operation Face Shield, worked together with those folks to kind of settle on a common design that U of M wanted to use to simplify the production and coordinate some help from a variety of different people. We got some help actually from BASF down in Wyandotte, which was really nice. They produced a lot of face shield material for us and really tried to kind of get everybody rallying around a similar approach. So to answer your question, Matt, exactly correct. We've been trying to coordinate some of the effort with the 3D Army.
Okay.
So your design actually came from the Czech Republic though, right?
It was originally from a thing called Prusa, and I would tell you, honestly, Mike, I'm not even sure I could tell you the lineage. It's probably an interesting family tree if you look at it, where the thing has slowly been tweaked. The original design had four posts, if you will, to snap on the plastic face shield. Well, some smart people looked at that and said, that's interesting. What if we got it so that you could literally use the three-hole punch from a paper punch and get it down to three pegs. So we made that modification. And then you just stuff that's just smart people thinking about how to make this thing better over time. So yeah, I think some of the lineage did come out of the Czech Republic. There were some other things that came out of different places. University of Wisconsin had done some things. So it's a really nice kind of amalgamation of a lot of different thinking. And then people saying, hey, if I put it together in this configuration, I can print six of them at the same time. Or if I put it in this way, I can print, two of them at the same time. Or if I set up the file this way, there's all kinds of laser cutting capacity of just typical plastic. So a lot of different things came into it.
And then who are the recipients of these? Are these going to U of M Hospital, St. Joe Veterans Center, or are they going beyond Ann Arbor?
They're going well beyond Ann Arbor. The group in Ann Arbor that's we've worked closely with are really two groups, a group out of MakerWorks, which is a makerspace in Ann Arbor. And then there's another group of folks that kind of coalesced from a variety of different makerspaces, whether it were high schools that had these 3D printers or like robotics clubs that had them. What kind of reminds me of my day and age, people used to build these Heathkit electronics things and you'd have stuff left over and people doing stuff, but you definitely had different people. And the short answer to your question, Mike, is that stuff's been distributed across the country. It's actually gone all over the place. So they've filled stuff, literally mailed stuff to people. I would say you just imagine where they have a listing on the site. I haven't looked at it in a while, but it's gone all over the place where people have asked for this stuff, but definitely a lot in the local hospitals. So all the way into Detroit as well. So a number of different places have gotten it.
Matt?
Yeah, that's what I've heard of a lot of sort of creative repurposing of materials here, like the plastic face shields have been made out of the plastic pages of a presentation or a booklet or something like that. And that's where the idea for the three-hole punch came from. It's like, hey, we got, 1,000 of these things sitting in a file cabinet, and it's going to take us 3 years to use them all. Meanwhile, you've got people who really need it in first responder situations. So tell me a little bit about the Rapid Reaction Steering Committee. Who's on that? How was that formed?
Yeah, so early on, there was kind of a coordination between the medical center, so Michigan Medicine, and the College of Engineering to say, hey, we have some, we're probably going to have some very specific needs that we want to address. And there's a command group inside of Michigan Medicine that, that really is trying to oversee the entire activity of the health system. But the engineering group in particular through Dean Gallimore and Steve Sessio kind of merged up with that group to try and focus the energy of the School of Engineering to address specific problems. So that's how that formed up, really, was kind of the primary leadership out of the health system and the primary leadership out of the School of Engineering, with a dialogue going on a fairly continuous basis about specific needs. There's been a number of other projects that kind of have been developed both within Michigan Medicine, jointly with the health system, everything from sanitization of masks, which people have also heard about this a lot, I'm sure, different methods, a lot of testing that's gone on to make sure the filtration capability of those masks is what we would anticipate after going through whatever that cleaning process is. Vent splitters, Michigan has developed a pretty specific vent splitter and some negative pressure helmets. A lot of stuff has come out of that. So probably really four or five really big projects through that collaboration and people trying to share their obvious expertise in the different areas.
So how difficult was it getting all this cobbled together? Or was a lot of people raising their hands wanting to get involved?
Yeah, I always, it's interesting. I worked with a group of people inside of the School of Engineering and the Operation Face Shield group and the Mirror Works group. And, you know, it's, if you ever question whether the notion of the fog of war exists or not, don't question that anymore, because it certainly, it took a while to get everybody coordinated. But the good thing is, I think everybody was even in the cases where you had some, I'll call it communication challenges, for lack of a better way to characterize it, it was all for the right effort. But, you know, definitely once we kind of got a little feedback from both the user community, because honestly, somebody's wearing this thing all day long, you really want to hear from them. Is it uncomfortable? What types of things could change? And then you're talking to people who say exactly your point, Matt. I've got, you know, six cases of overhead slides that I used back in the day when we had overhead projectors. It'd be great if I could use these, but you know, that type of stuff, I would tell you easily within, you know, 7 to 10 days, most of the big kinks were ironed out, and people have really done a lot of amazing work. It's always interesting to me when you give good guidance, the ingenuity and capacity and generosity of people is pretty much unbounded.
Okay, and so is this part of the tech transfer office, or is this independent of that and just part of engineering?
It's kind of independent of that. I have a small secret I could tell you. I was a respiratory therapist for 6 years at the beginning of my career, and that's how I paid my way through my undergrad degree. So very early on, I asked if there was stuff that I could do, because I had a pretty clear understanding of what I think some of my former colleagues, both therapists, doctors, and nurses would be facing. So I kind of volunteered and ended up working with the College of Engineering as part of it. So that's the genesis. Not really a tech transfer effort, but certainly with respect to those other activities and trying to get them out to as many people who could benefit from them, such as the sterilization or the vent splitter. We definitely have been central to that.
Okay. So if folks want to participate in this project, if they're a maker or whatever, the 3D printer at home, is it still open? Are you still looking for people to recruit?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we're definitely continuing to accept those things. I can send you the URL to where those specs are. I can give it to you. It's basically specs.engin.umich.edu, and that will tell you exactly the specifications we're accepting. We also link out to the Operation Face Shield site and the MakerWorks site. And I can't say enough good things about both those groups of people, because they're really, really, really great community partners.
Okay. And if folks want to reach out to you personally, how would they do that, Drew?
If you go look out up the U of M Tech Transfer site under the team side, my listing is there, and you'd be happy to chat with you.
All right. Thanks very much, Drew Bennett from University of Michigan Tech Transfer and the Rapid Response, Rapid Reaction Steering Committee at U of M, helping us all through this pandemic. We'll be back with another segment of the M Squared TechCast in just a moment. For right now, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're watching at podcastdetroit.com and mitechnews.tv.
Lawrence Technological University is all about opportunities. You learn beyond the campus, doing real-world research for top companies and honing your skills through co-ops and internships. Apply what you learn. Be challenged. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Lawrence Technological University graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU fifth among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Came in, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. Got it.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch
and Mike Brennan. You caught us there.
And we're back with another segment of the M Squared TechCast, and we have with us our friendly epidemiology expert, infectious disease expert, Fred Brown. Fred, you wanted to talk to us today about an app that you're working on that I think has real potential here. So, Mike, unless you have another question, why don't we just let Fred start talking about this app?
Yeah, I looked at your slides real briefly before we came on air, but I got the general gist of what you're up to. And I know you pretty much in the very basic stages of it, but the app, essentially what it would do was it would tell you whether you can engage in daily activities. And for instance, in the slides that I looked at, if somebody had diabetes, you check that off on your health questionnaire. And then it would say, maybe it's not such a good idea to be in this area because the COVID contagion is very high. But it's your creation. Why don't you kind of explain it and walk us through this?
Sounds like a plan. I'd be happy to. Let me share my screen with you, and we'll take a quick look at the app. Basically, what's happened is that I get calls from people, and they say, you know, I've got my grandmother, or I've got this issue, and I really want to do something. You know, I want to move from her nursing home, or I want to go out and do certain things. And as I was working with different governors, I realized that basically a lot of the governors are going to allow the citizens to make their own choices about them, these things, because we have quite a different perception of our risk levels, and we also have quite different levels of risk tolerance as individuals. And so I wanted to create something that would allow people to be flexible in the way they applied the app, both for themselves and for people in their lives. So with that, why don't I take a quick look and basically point out this is really happening on a global basis. So the app is intended to be free, and it's intended to be global. But I'll focus on the United States. And one of the people who I wanted to focus on is kind of a new tool set to help with pandemic management. And what's nice about this tool set is it's going to allow us to integrate both what the governors are doing, what individuals are doing, and what businesses are doing with a common set of data. So we can kind of tell and see how we're influencing with our own behavior the overall environment. So this is the support tool. Basically, there are three big factors that I think everyone has to think about. The first one is how risky is the environment? And basically, that's determined by the virus itself. And what we're doing to encourage the virus to continue to reproduce or to move down. And so how risky is the environment? I look at viral activity, the healthcare capacity. If you do get sick, is the hospital available? Testing levels, because we want to make sure that the models are being run appropriately with the right levels of data. And crowd levels, because crowds really are what generate, you know, your position and time, amount of time you spend in a crowd really determine, and if that person, those of people in the crowd are ill and not knowing it, they're asymptomatic frequently, they could pass on the disease to you. So those three areas, those four areas for riskiness in the environment. Then you have to kind of say, how risky am I? And that's based on age. We know that basically once you get over 70, even 60, sadly, your risk of fatality from this disease is significantly higher. Sex does make a difference. Estrogen levels seem to reduce the risk of fatality and intubation requirements. Late stage COVID, there's no preference for the virus to go after male or female. But once you get the disease, if you're male, you don't have as good an outcome as females do. Your medical condition, of course, you talked about diabetes. That's a big one. Being overweight, especially a BMI of over 40, can affect you. Smoking, of course, affects. It's a respiratory disease. Asthma can affect you. Cancers can affect you because you're immunosuppressed frequently with the drugs you're on. And, of course, heart disease is the big one. So if you're hypertensive, which unfortunately about 60% of us are once we get over 60 years old, that's a big one. And heart disease itself. Immunity level also. Eventually, we're going to find out that we're immune or not immune because we've actually been infected before. And then the last area is how risky is the activity? Can I get exposed to the disease while I'm doing this activity? How long am I going to be doing this activity? How mobile am I during this activity level? And are there alternatives to the activity? So those kind of three big things are what each of us, I think, in the era of COVID, if it is as dangerous and deadly as we think it is right now, we'll kind of have to use a weather forecast. And every day we'll get up in the morning, like our friend Blake does. And oh, here's Blake, and he's 61. He lives in San Francisco. He's with one of our partners, Google, and he's been at home since the 15th. His mom lives in a nursing home in Arizona, so you can start to get some of the use cases here. I mean, you want to check up on his mom. You may want to take a look. You may want to have his wife do some things for him, and his adult son also. And Blake is running out of meds, unsurprisingly, and he wants to know, is it safe for him to pick them up at the pharmacy? So the first thing he does is the night before Governor Newsom, this is California, so it's Governor Newsom, but Governor Whitmore would be the same thing. He does a one-time kind of notation, like you said, Mike, on this. He says, okay, I do have diabetes, but the rest of it I don't have, so I'll put this into the formula, and tomorrow morning, on the next day, the tool comes up and he hits his little application device on his phone, and he has a weather forecast. And the weather forecast indicates a reproductive rate, which is the R0 we've talked about before. That's the effective reproductive rate of the virus in that state. And we have this now for every state. It's been quite, we've been monitoring this for about, oh boy, we have over a billion data points now. We've been monitoring this for probably 45-50 days. It's quite predictive of what's going to happen in the future. And so we like this tool. But it's not quite enough. We want to have more data sets. And so we're also using a modeling tool that helps us decide whether we're going up a curve at a peak or coming down a curve in terms of new caseload. Right now you can see that we're past peak, which is a good thing because that means every day past your peak, you're going down the curve until you hit a low number. 0.86 means we're not quite down to 0.5. That's when you'd expect us to be at the very bottom of the peak. But you can see that decrease still going. So overall, the forecast looks pretty good, and his mom's doing well in Arizona, so that's all good. So then he kind of zips in a little bit closer, takes a look at California more closely, and it's a lower risk environment today. Virus has passed its peak, looking good. The fight, California is winning the fight, and it still is, by the way. California is in pretty good shape, with the exception of some parts of Los Angeles. So Blake can now drill down right into California. He's in San Francisco, not Los Angeles, which is a good thing. But actually, in San Francisco itself, it's a medium risk today. You can see the active cases of it has increased recently. The new daily cases have increased recently, and the average new cases per day is 52, and that is over target. Right now, Germany, for example, has an average new case per day of 35 throughout the whole country, and Governor Cuomo just said he wants an average number of new cases, I believe, of less than 10. So that's those are getting really strict in terms of how risky or not risky it is. We can vary this based on what the local laws are, so that everyone can tune in pretty easily. So that's the environment. Now he wants to take a look at where he's actually going today. He's in San Francisco, so he takes a look and sees what's going on really with the hospital situation and the testing centers. And the testing centers are slow, and that's bad because if he gets a contact with somebody, he wants to go and get pretty quickly tested to find out whether or not he's gotten infected or not. After about 2 or 3 days, they can tell this if you suddenly got into contact with somebody. So luckily, there are two there with 24-hour turnaround. That's a good thing. The positive test rate is 5.2%. That's way high. That means we're not testing enough. Our testing density is that high. It should be below 3%. Otherwise, we were getting a high positive test rate because we're just not testing enough people as we would expect. And then the hospital bed shortages looking good. Fatality rate well above normal, 1.6%. Not bad. So he's in pretty good shape. He says maybe I can venture out today. But there's tools saying, well, you know, like you're a little bit, you know, you're not that in great shape. So if you have to go out, stay in if possible today. Use PPE because it's still going down. Maintain social distancing and only enter venues using your best safety practices. So now we're starting to get into the activity that he's planning for himself. First, he goes back and he kind of checks. So how risky am I? And Blake is actually at a 2.8. That means he's got a fatality percentage rate of 2.8% with his diabetes and his age. He's 61. Plus he has diabetes. So that's a pretty high susceptible rate. He's compromised and he's susceptible. And so now with that in mind, if we were young people, we probably, you know, we wouldn't even think twice about it. We go out there because we're basically in a green zone. If we're older, kind of in the 80s, you'd probably isolate yourself here. You probably wouldn't think about going out at all, pretty much. If you're compromised, that means you're young, but you've got a disease state, you have to kind of talk to your doctor and figure out just how much risk you're at. But all this app actually looks at what we know about fatality rates with susceptibility versus your age. And based on that, it maps where you are. And you can see Blake is up in that upper left-hand corner, which is a dark orange. Not great. So with that, he then takes a look at the activity, right? So it's not just walking in the park. He's actually going to go into what could be a crowded downtown area for our pharmacy. And that's not so great. The other problem is that this is the day of Governor Newsom's opening up the entire economy. And so it's probably a lot of pent up demand. So based on other states who've opened up like Oklahoma, South Carolina and others, we pretty much know that although right now, today, Sunday or Monday, that we would see 41% to baseline versus what he was seeing before the pandemic. We look at this versus March 1st. So March 1st levels were 41% less than normal, but because it's the day of the opening, we think that actually he could be as much as only 20% below opening, which is going to be pretty crowded in certain times of day. So if you have to pick up the meds today, then he has to really look at some of what the pharmacy is doing for him. At the pharmacy, what he's able to do is he's able to stay outside the pharmacy. It's a CVS. He wants to CVS. That's his local guy. And he sees that he's well ventilated. There's hand sanitizer around. He's got his own. He's got no lines, shielded checkout. His masks and what he notices, everyone's going in and out without any being counted. There's no restrictions in that. There's no masks and gloves worn by people who are going in and out. The 6 feet distancing looks like it's not being withheld because the aisles are pretty tight. There's no hand washing. They don't have any signage about the fact that the employees are washing down the surfaces after it's being touched. And there's no thermal screening. So look, he sees these things and he says, well, you know, it's not exactly safe. And it's pretty crowded today at this point in time. So he looks and says, maybe I could go to a different CVS. So he looks and says, you know, here are all the different CVSs in town. And actually in Los Angeles, they have a Yelp type app that actually says, here are the companies and that are doing well with social distancing, well with cleaning and keeping things going. And here are the sites and the businesses that aren't doing so well. And so we think that this is going to become pretty popular in the future, and that there'll be apps like this pretty regularly, people saying, hey, I went to this place and it was a mess, or hey, I went to this place and they really did a nice job. And you can then decide, let me go to that one instead of this one. Or maybe he wants to go to they'll advertise, we have a pickup window for your drugs. You don't have to come into the store. Or they have automatic delivery. Well, after he goes through all this, he decides at the end of the day, with his environment, the risk of the environment being 0.86, which is good. It's a green light. But his own risk and the risk of activity at that particular store is probably too bad, because the line at the pharmacy means he's going to have to stay in that store for quite a while. They didn't seem to have very good social distancing in place, and so he decides that he'll have his younger son pick it up for him, and that he'll use this now to think about going to a picnic at the park with his wife tomorrow. And of course, this app also would tell you which parks are open and which parks have a lot of availability and aren't too crowded. So with that, that's the sort of the daily routine I think people will start to use should we continue to find that COVID is extremely dangerous for some risk for some people, and that some of these activities are more risky than others, and you want to be able to weigh that risk each time you do it. And especially, you can imagine you're flying into a town, a new town, and being on the road and needing to have this new information set for you. It's because it's available everywhere. So what do you guys think?
Where do I sign up?
Now, where is this in development, Fred? Is this still kind of a concept, or have you moved forward on development?
Well, luckily, there are a couple of big companies that have decided to try to help us. Google's helping us to some extent, a small extent, or they're considering what they want to do with us. Tableau is definitely helping us with some front-end applications. We've got the whole thing in the Azure cloud, so we have the data sets we need for the most part. The challenge is making an app. You know, I'm not an app guy, and so we're trying to find people who really know a lot about app production. You know, you've got to have both the Apple environment and the Android environment supported. We're talking to Apple shortly, and so on. So we've got a ways to go, just because. And of course, we're trying to do this for free, and so we're using the best we can from people who are available and like it.
Well, I have some suggestions, but I'll give them to you once the show is over. So
I appreciate.
I don't want to do any endorsements here, So
RedBrown.com, just send them in. I'd love them.
All right, sounds great. All right. So, we're at the end of the show. And once again, we want to thank Fred Brown for joining us. It's always a very interesting segment. And we'll have him back next week. And maybe we'll have some more progress on the app, or we could talk a little bit more about how are we going to, because we're getting close to the point, I hope, when Michigan's going to open up after Memorial Day. And everyone's wondering what's going to happen, right?
Absolutely.
So. All right, cool. Well, thanks again for being on the show today. This is Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Roush.
And you've been watching MI Tech TV, and we will see you next week.
Thanks for listening to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving.